and welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate overlooked, ignored, derided, and just plain hated contributions to pop culture. Novels, movies, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is a man who, since leaving his career as an actor, has become a sort of power behind the throne in new media. He was the first full-time marketing director at Oni Press, head of marketing for Namco Bandai's Trans-Pacific comic studio Shifty Look, and is now a sort of business manager stroke exec producer and all-round chief whip at Toonhound, home of the webcomic phenomena PvP, Table Titans, and more. You may also know him from the excellent Surviving Creativity podcast, where he regularly quizzes creators on how they manage their working lives. He is, of course, Mr. Corey Cassone. Corey, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yep, very glad to have you here. Now, you are, I believe, the first person on the show to choose this particular type of work, which has me very excited. So without further ado, why don't you tell us what you've chosen and then give us some context around, well, I normally would say it's release, but this is quite an old thing, so that might be difficult. Instead, just tell us, just give us an idea of why it's maligned and why you think that that's wrong.
I chose a board game. And I chose
the board game,
the greatest board game ever created. Certainly the best selling board game ever created, and that's the game of Monopoly. And I know I can hear listeners rolling their eyes. And I believe it's unjustly maligned because in modern day, because people don't follow the rules. That is the number one reason why people dislike the game, and tends to be just this morning. I was at a coffee shop and I was brushing up on some of my knowledge because I actually haven't played in quite a while. But I had my Monopoly Companion with me, a fantastic book. If you haven't read it, you should, if you're interested in playing Monopoly. And the gentleman waiting bar was just immediately, Monopoly, oh God. just right out of the gate. Like it was, I didn't even have a chance to speak to him. And I said, well, what's the problem? And he goes, you can never finish a game. And I said, a game should take no more than 90 minutes. And he thought I was insane. And in fact, most games that I've played take about 45 minutes to play. The number one gripe with most people about Monopoly is that it's an unending game. It takes longer than Risk, you know, or Twilight Imperium, or some of these huge sprawling board games, or Diplomacy, or something like that. It's, you know, people, they love Risk, an entirely chance-based game, right, that can take a decade to play, and they hate Monopoly, which is in fact a really well built and refined game. Partially because it's so old, it's a very old game, and people don't realize it. It came from the turn of the century, from the really like 1900, 1903. But the genesis of it kind of started in the 1890s, and in the 1870s and 1880s. And people, you know, they forget that. So in today's culture, there's this hate for Monopoly, and not just with players, but with game makers, which just crushes me because I love games. I absolutely love them. And to have a whole generation of game makers, you know, these designers and players dislike what is really an elegant game, that hurts me a lot. And I want to set the record straight. This is why I'm on this show.
Well, I was going to say, is the game really hated? I mean, I know most people only ever drag it out to play during the holiday season when the family's over and you need something that everybody can play and lots of people can play at once. So it's like, okay, everybody gather around and we'll have a game of Monopoly. And I know that for most people is their sole, you know, experience with the game. But even so, is it really so maligned within the industry?
You know, it is. There are a couple of famous reviewers and designers, and they call a certain series of games they call Roll the Dice, Move Your Mice. You know, and it's exactly what it sounds like. These are games where you roll the dice and you move your piece along, and then, you know, somebody wins and somebody loses.
Snakes and Ladders.
Sure. And in truth, when board games first hit their peak, and we have sort of another rise happening recently as German board gaming sort of came to America. But board games were a big deal in the 1890s through like through the first war and really into the Great Depression. I mean, they were a big deal. Every time there's a depression or a recession, board games take off because it's a one-time purchase that can provide you with just hours and hours and hours of entertainment, days and days of entertainment.
Literally in the case of Risk.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. But the replay value on games is considerable. You know, and especially the simpler the game is, which is always, when you're looking at game design, that's always a big deal. You know, if you can make it simple, it's good. But in the early days of American gaming, most games were targeted at kind of family fun, and they were built so that anybody could understand them, specifically children. And that meant that games had a beginning and an end, usually a single line that you followed, right? And a game like Snakes and Ladders changes the line. But essentially, you have a beginning and an end. You know, you've got the game of life. There's a beginning and an end. You've got Snakes and Ladders. There's a beginning and an end. All those kind of Candyland, right? All those classic games have a beginning and an end. And then your sort of things happen to you along the way. It's why adults find these games so boring. Monopoly was actually one of the first games that had a continuous path. Game just goes around and around and around and around, right?
Right, it has win conditions rather than a winning line.
But initially it didn't. This is what's so interesting. So when the game was first made in 1903, it was a continuous path game, and that was the first thing that was new and interesting. In 1903, there weren't any games like this. Everybody was building games with a beginning and an end, right? Even some card games hadn't really taken off yet. Bridge and Whist and some of this stuff. It existed, but people weren't really playing it. If you bought a game, you were literally buying, you know, Candyland. It wasn't Candyland at the time, but you were buying a game that your pieces started on one side and everybody rolled their dice. You roll the dice, you move your little mice along, and then somebody gets to the end first and they win and everyone hurrahs and then you play again, right? Monopoly, you went around the board. And then in fact, in the original incarnation, you only went around five times. And then at the end of the fifth circuit, whoever had the most resources won the game.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
The game was built as a teaching tool. So I mean, I don't know how deep into the history of this you want to get. We're far off track now, but you know, back to why it's really maligned in this day and age is because people don't follow the rules. And the rules are actually very simple. It's, you know, roll your dice, move around the board, acquire properties, and exchange money. And at the end, the game ends when there's only one person left. When one person has all the money, all the assets.
Because everyone else is bankrupt.
Sure. And typically, that will take 45 to 90 minutes. But in America, and this thing started where when you hit income tax, which if you look at a board, it's a fourth space from go to your left. You are required to pay either 10% of, you know, of your total assets or what you just earned by pass and go, your wages. What most people do is they take this money and they put it in the middle of the board, and then whoever lands on free parking gets that money. And they do that not just with income tax, but also with any of the chance or community chess cards that make you pay. So what they're doing is they're artificially lengthening the game by keeping money from leaving the table.
Right, by keeping money in the system.
They've broken the game without even realizing. They think they're making it more fun, but really what they're doing is they're making a 90-minute game take 4 hours.
I've never actually heard of that house rule. I came across it when I was reading up on this ready for the show, but I've never actually played a game using that house rule. Maybe that's a uniquely American thing. I don't know.
You know, I'm not sure. It is the most common house rule that I hear, and it is, in my opinion, it is the one utterly game-breaking rule. The other one that I don't particularly like is when everyone starts with property. That will actually speed up the game because you immediately have properties, but I think that also takes a good element out of the game. So I think that the house rules are why the game is so horribly maligned, and I think it's a lack of understanding of the game, not just the game itself, but the simplicity of the game and the beauty of it as not just as a game to play and have fun, but also as a teaching tool. You know, kids can learn so much about money and finance and counting and, you know, all these things that they need in life. Ironically, the game of life teaches you nothing about life, but Monopoly can actually teach you a great deal.
Have you seen, and I think I mentioned this to you before, have you seen the blog post by Johnny Nexus about the same thing? You only think Monopoly is rubbish because you're playing it wrong, but he talks about a different house rule, which is In the official rules, when you land on a vacant property, you have the option to buy it. If you pass on the option to buy it, that property then is auctioned by the bank to any player, including that same player who just declined to purchase it. So it enables...
Absolutely.
It enables you potentially to get something, you know, going for a song, but it also means that all the properties get bought really quickly, as opposed to rule everybody seems to implement where you...
I just don't want it.
Yeah, where you land on it and you say, no, I don't want it, and so you just carry on and roll again, and then it takes forever for everybody to buy all the properties.
First of all, I haven't read this piece and I don't know Johnny, but thank you, sir, for for loving this game.
It's from 2005, but it keeps getting resurrected on social media every so often. I mean, who knows, it may again now that we've mentioned it on here.
Absolutely. And as it should, yeah.
I'll put a link to it in the show notes. It's a really good piece. And he makes a really good point that hardly anyone ever bothers to actually read the rules.
Yeah, they all assume they know how to play the game and they sit down to play. And
because they've been taught by their parents.
Yeah. And what's really funny is the rules for the game don't even take up an entire page.
Oh, they're really short. Yeah.
They're very short. Yeah. It's not like a Euro game where you're going to have to read 20 pages.
But I think that's part of the problem, because everybody thinks, well, the only thing you need to remember is that if you buy on a vacant property, you can either buy it or not. And if you land on an owned property, you need to pay the rent. And that's basically it, because everything else that you need to know is written right there on the board or on the cards that the board directs you to pick up. So everybody thinks, well, as long as you remember those things, everything else is just there on the board. You don't need to remember anything else. But of course, that's not true.
Well, and here's the thing. I hated Monopoly. I'm going to come out and say it. I really disliked Monopoly for years, but mostly because of the same reason.
Because you were playing it wrong, yeah.
Right. I had only played it as a kid. I was playing it incorrectly. Then in the early 2000s, we had better, you know, shipping in the world and internet existed and that kind of stuff. And Eurogaming started coming to America. And I was in college at the time, and I had learned that I could purchase these games, these particularly German family style games.
Settlers of Catan and all that, yeah.
Absolutely. Settlers of Catan, Bonanza, the list goes, Condottiere, the list goes on and on, right? These are amazing games, really, truly amazing games. So what had happened in Europe was after World War II, particularly in Germany, war games, and I believe still to this day, are banned. You can't make them or sell them.
I'm not sure about that. It may have been the case. I'm not sure if it's true anymore.
May not be true anymore.
Yeah.
But because of that, people started making these really interesting family games. And even now today, I know some German people that they say that it's a family tradition to eat dinner and play a game. Mm-hmm. So you have these beautifully elegant, easy to understand, but utterly complex games. And German games are based on interaction. Whereas American games were based on going from point A to point B, German games were based on interaction. And the reason why Monopoly was so successful for so many years, because it was based on interaction. You were going around the board continuously. It never stopped. And the way to win was to interact with the other players at the table. I was obsessed with this in college. And I was buying German games. I couldn't read a word of it, right? So I'd have to buy German games and then I'd have to find some translation to the rules online, in some cases find Germans to translate the cards of these games for me. And then I was creating groups of people to come and play these games. Now you see Green Bay Packers are obsessed with Settlers of Catan. And I think that's fantastic, but I was that obsessed 15 years ago. Right. And I was making other people obsessed with it, and nobody had played a game before. And this is why Settlers is still a really good game to teach people. If you want to get them into gaming, the first game that they play of Settlers, they're going to hoard their cards. They're not going to understand that they can't win unless they trade. No, the second game they're going to trade, but they're going to do it in a cutthroat style. And they're going to realize after their first or second trade, nobody's going to trade with them, because they're not comporting themselves in a way where they're a good player. They're not fun to play with. By their third or fourth game, you can actually watch American players' attitude shift entirely.
Watch them get it.
Yeah, right. So I was not a fan of this game. I graduated college. I went to California. My wife and I were working. My wife is in grad school, and she had a group of friends in grad school, and we would all get together, and poker started taking off. It was a big deal. This is when the big boom of like Texas Hold'em, and it started showing on TV and that kind of thing. Yeah, and there were a lot of card houses in California. So I met a bunch of guys that were into playing cards. And I, being a big, you know, dork that I am, started showing up to card night with board games. Right. And before we knew it, we were staying up till 3 and 4 in the morning playing these board games. And it was every time the new Essen Award came out, or Spiel des Jahres, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that, sorry Germans, or whatever. Every time one of these awards came out, I would buy the top 10 games. I was spending thousands of dollars a year on these games, but I was importing them into America at great expense. In retrospect, I wasted a ridiculous amount of money, but the hours of entertainment gained were totally worth it.
No, it's not wasted if you got entertainment out of it, is it?
Absolutely, right? So we were playing these games, and this went on for years. And then one of the people I played with, whose name is Matt McNally, who went on to become the 2004 United States Monopoly champion. We'll get into tournament play in a minute. He one night, very late at night, said, we'd finished playing a game, and he said, does anybody want to play Monopoly? And immediately everyone at the table went, oh God, it's like 2 a.m., man. This is ridiculous. And he said to the table, play it with me, and I guarantee you the game will take 90 minutes or less, which was pretty average for any game we played.
Uh-huh.
And we said, we'll take that bet, sir. And he brought out Monopoly. He reiterated the rules to us to make sure everyone understood. And the first game was over in about 40 minutes.
Right, yeah.
And of course, Matt had won.
Played properly, yeah.
Sure. And everyone at the table, first we were dumbfounded at how he had managed this feat, because he was getting us to trade and do things that we had never really done in Monopoly before, and we were going along with it. So then we immediately, of course, it's very late at night, we all went, screw you, we're playing again. That was ridiculous. You don't get to pick the game and then beat us. And not just beat us, but absolutely crush us, right? So we played again. And this time, of course, we're all wary about trading with him. And that game took about 35 minutes. Now it took even less time. So now we're obsessed. Now we're playing Monopoly every day, every night, all night, 4 or 5 hours sometimes, 5, 6 games at a time. And he's doing things we've never seen before. He's rolling the dice, and instead of counting the spaces, he's rolling the dice and just picking up his piece and moving it to where he should be. That's the first thing he did that freaked us all out. We went, wait a minute, go back and count it. We don't trust you. You know, clearly he's cheating to right, beat us, right? This is a game where you roll the dice and move your mice. There's no strategy here. How are you beating us? How are you winning every time? What are you doing? And as we start playing with him, we realize he's bamboozled us. There's a Monopoly tournament coming up, and he wants people to help train.
Oh, wow. He's a card shark.
A little bit, yeah. And he knows things about the game that we don't know. But as we play, we start becoming better opponents. And after a while, he says, hey, guys, you know, there's the U.S. Championship is coming up. Why don't we all enter? Why don't we all play? Huh. You're all really good players now. And we went, well, a tournament Monopoly? What the hell is this all about? Well, and it is the most fun thing you've ever done. Games are limited to 90 minutes. Most games finish early. You're awarded points based on your game. Everyone has an alias that they play under. At the table, you go by your actual name, but points are awarded under aliases, so nobody knows who everyone is at the game. You'll never play the game with more wonderful opponents, because nobody wants to offend anybody. Everyone is really comporting themselves well. You know, you it's a game where you would expect people to be evil, awful. You would expect diplomacy level, cutthroat, ambitious, just a-holes, right? That's not the case at all. You're going to get the most amazing players you've ever got.
Well, that's funny, because part of Johnny Nexus's thesis in the piece that he wrote was that he hypothesizes that the reason the house rule was introduced and that the auction for vacant properties was dropped was because of the potential for it to cause terrible upset within families when you're playing with children who don't really, you know, who just want to roll the dice and move the mice, as you would say, and don't actually care about strategy and bluffing and bidding and all that.
That's possible. I would argue with anyone who who feels that way, because I think that's true of the free parking rule that happens in America a lot, where everyone puts the money in and then whoever gets free parking wins. Yay. It's like the lottery. I would argue with people as a father of a young boy. And we're trying to teach him things, that one of the beautiful things about Monopoly is it teaches you about the realities of life and finances. And these are things that people don't know anymore.
Right, but Corey, you are a middle-class family living in Portland. Right. I don't wish to offend you, but your family experience is probably not completely representative.
Not at all. Absolutely not. I don't disagree with that, but I think these are skills that people need. And I'll give you some examples. I know how to balance a checkbook. Do you?
Yes.
Okay. Does a 23-year-old?
I don't know. I did when I was 23, but that's because I grew up in a blue-collar working-class household where we sure. never had any money.
Yeah, as did I. You had to watch every penny, right?
Yeah.
I would argue that many under 30s don't actually know how to manage their finances for two reasons. One being credit cards, right? Everything's digital now.
Right, yeah.
And the other being they weren't taught this by their parents, and schools stopped teaching it a while ago. So this goes back to the 1930s and 40s, right? Post-World War II, this kind of stuff was actually being taught. Remember, in 1950s America, there was the American dream. You can come to America, you can work really hard, and you can be whatever you want.
Make your fortune, yeah.
You can make it. It's one of those things that I think is, I think we now have a generation of kids who believe that that's not possible anymore. I would argue that it actually is. And it's even easier now than ever before, because now we have these tools. We have these technologies. We talk about this on Surviving Creativity a lot. We have these technologies now where you can do things that your predecessors, your parents and grandparents, could have never done. You know, my grandfather would bale wire in the summertime and he was a business owner. And he would go out after he was done running his business. He would go out to factories and he would bale wire to earn extra money because they wanted their children to move a little farther ahead in life. Mm. You know, my parents did the same thing. They always were taking extra jobs, extra work so that they could better my life. I can now do that digitally. I don't have to.
True.
Do you see what I'm saying?
I don't think it's necessarily any easier or harder than it was. I think what it is an awareness. There is an increased awareness among people of the millions and millions of people who don't achieve the American dream. I think it's similar to this notion that crime, you know, in the last 20 years is on the rise and it's rampant and it's not safe to go out anywhere at night.
In fact, it's way down.
Yeah, in fact, crime is down pretty much everywhere in the civilized world. It's
absolutely,
just that we are so much more aware of the crimes that do happen.
Sure. But coming back to Monopoly, I think that it's a game that can teach skills that people today need.
I wonder, I mean, you clearly do teach your child to play it, but I wonder, do parents still teach their kids how to play Monopoly? I mean, think of the cultural impact that Monopoly's had. Not only talking about how unique it was at the time and stuff, as you've mentioned, but even now, we literally call fake-looking cash Monopoly money. You know, everybody knows, every adult anyway, knows what Monopoly is and what you mean when you mention that game. But I wonder, how many people under 20 these days know what it means or what the context is or what the origin of the phrase Monopoly money is? Or is this cycle still ongoing, do you think?
I think it's still ongoing. And the reason I don't just think that I know that is because it's not well handled by Hasbro, who owns the game. Mm-hmm. It's not well understood by players because, frankly, most people don't read the rules. They're taught by the previous generation, was taught by the previous generation. And I don't think there's anything wrong or bad intrinsically with house rules. But the game itself was developed, again, over three decades to play.
Yeah, the problem with house rules is that by definition, they bring imbalance into the game rules. And you have to be aware of what effect you're having on the rules.
Absolutely. And I will say and the reason why I say Hasbro has mishandled this game, and a lot of players, you know, of the game that are fans and proponents of the game actually believe this. Hasbro started putting house rules in the game. They even invented their own house rule called the speed die and introduced that into the game. And now you cannot buy a board now without this speed die, which completely destroys the game, by the way. If you you get a game of Monopoly, just take that die and just throw it away. I mean, really, they introduced the die to try and speed up the game. And this was a thing.
And what they actually should have done was just put a big notice in there in big red letters saying, read the rules, you idiots.
Right. Well, and here's what we found. So in 2004, Matt won the U.S. Monopoly tournament. And the world championships that year were being held in Tokyo, Japan. And he said, this is going back to him teaching us how to play. He said, I need a training team. I need you guys to play with me over and over and over again. And I need you to take on the guys, the role of different types of players.
Huh.
So you know how, like, when you play D&D, for instance, you have the rules lawyer, and you've got the role player, and you've
the
got
min-maxer
the min-maxer. Yeah. So you have these different types of personalities when you play a game. The same is true of Monopoly. And in fact, people are different when they play Monopoly than they are in real life. It's, you know, you take on a certain role, and sometimes you change what role you're playing at the table based on what's happening in the game.
Well, like a game of poker.
Absolutely. Or a game of chess, for that matter. I mean, this game really, there's really some serious intricacy to this game. So we trained him for months, and then several of us went with him to Japan to play in the world championships. We were playing pickup games. We weren't playing the actual, only the each country's winner was playing the championships. We were playing pickup games on the side. And after his rounds of tournaments at night, we would play different variations of what happened so that he could prepare ahead. And we weren't the only ones. Apparently, Matt was the first U.S. player in a very long time to do this. Other countries do it regularly. The Japanese champion, who's been the champion 3 or 4 times now, he flies to other countries with his team. And they watch the country's championships and take notes on the players and how they play so that he can go back to Japan and prepare for the world championships.
Wow, like football coaches watching tape.
Absolutely. It is, and this is totally true. Let's talk about the rules real quick of the game, because this is what people probably want to know about.
Yeah, go on.
You choose a piece. Everyone starts with $1,500. 5 ones, 5 tens, 6 twenties, and 2 50s, 200s, and 2 500s. So everyone starts with $1,500. You choose a piece, you roll to see who goes first, and you roll your way around the board, collecting money every time you pass go. Every time you have to pass go. Every time you pass go, you collect $200. And outside of that, you just follow the rules. There are 28 deeds in the game, so there are 28 properties that you can purchase. There are 16 chance cards and 16 community chess cards. There are 32 houses and 12 hotels. Okay. And that is literally the whole game. Roll your dice, move around the board. So here's where the strategy comes in. When you land on a property, your option is to purchase it or to auction it. 9 times out of 10, you're going to purchase your property. You're just going to buy it immediately. And you purchase that property, you take the deed into hand, and then the deed represents the purchase value of the property, or you can mortgage it. You can flip it over and get a portion of that value back in cash to use for other things, right? You form a monopoly when you have the entirety of a color group. It's usually 2 or 3 properties of the same color. And once you've formed a monopoly, you can build houses and hotels on that property. And houses are built sequentially, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then from the fourth house to a hotel. You can't skip ahead. You can't, you know, decide to go straight to a hotel, for instance.
Yeah.
And you have to build in sequence. So you can't have an overloaded property or something like that. And each property has a different value and a payoff. So as you go around the board, from the start of the board, the first color groups, which traditionally are sort of brown and light blue, those color groups are the cheapest to both purchase and to build on. But they're the lowest payoff return. So they give you the least amount of money in rent when someone lands on your property. And then as you go around the board, it gets more expensive until you get to the dark blues, which are the properties right before go, which have the highest return in terms of rent, but also the highest cost in terms of building. As you go around the board, right, you get into a situation in which now you're not just landing on empty properties and purchasing them. Now you're landing on properties that belong to another player, and you're paying them rent. So now you're in a situation in which the first about 3 times around the board, properties are being purchased. Right about the 4th or 5th time around the board, you're going to start paying rent. And when you're purchasing properties, money is leaving the game. It's going to the bank. Then when you're paying rent, money is changing hands between players. So now money is only going into the bank when you hit a community chest, a chance card, or when you owe somebody rent. So, money's only leaving the game when you hit usually a chance card, or if you hit income tax on the board. There's some other cards that make money leave the game. Otherwise, the money is just changing hands between players. The problem is, statistically, it's very unlikely that you're going to get a full color group, a whole monopoly, just by going around the board. You need to trade with other players. And this is where the game gets really interesting. Properties have a value on them, an attributed value, that is the cost that you purchased it for. But they also have an intrinsic value because each property has a percentage chance to land on the board. This is where the idea of a continuous board gets really interesting. Mm. So you're rolling two die. And what's the most commonly rolled number when you're rolling two die?
Seven, I believe, isn't it?
Seven, yeah. Seven is the most commonly rolled number. So you can figure out the most commonly rolled numbers. It goes seven, and then it goes 8-6, and then from there it goes,
9-5,
yeah. And it's like a pyramid, right? With seven being in the middle and the outside numbers going down. If you sit down, because it's a continuous board and there's 10 spaces per side, and you roll an infinite number of dice, with seven being the most probable number and working your way down, you can figure out the frequency of landing for each color group all the way around the board.
Oh, wow. So it's like card counting almost.
Yeah, exactly like that. And once you've figured out the percentage value going around the board, then you can figure out the percentage payoff for the cost of developing each of those properties. So now the properties don't just have a value that you paid. And this is where the game gets really interesting. Because if you're playing with just, your family or friends, you might be hesitant to trade someone a property because they already have two of the same color, they're creating a monopoly, or you're giving them a key where they have two of the three and one's still open, they might be able to trade somewhere else. So that might cause you to raise the value a little bit. But once you understand the percentages of landing on those properties, and you don't need to do this, but it really brings something interesting to the game, now it has an intrinsic value. So the most landed on color group in the game, do you want to take a stab at it?
Or I wouldn't even like to guess.
It's the oranges.
Oh, huh.
Which are right in the middle of the board. So they're the color group right before free parking. If you roll an infinite number of dice and you put the cards into effect, and the fact that people are coming out of jail, and when they come out of jail, most commonly rolled numbers are going to be, seven,
right,
then eight,
yep,
then nine and ten, working your way down, right? They're more likely to hit one of the orange color group than any other color group. In fact, they're going to hit it 50% of the time they go around the board.
So actually, those are some of the most valuable properties on the board.
Not only that, they're some of the cheapest to develop. Because houses, at that point around the board, houses are really only costing $100 every time you want to build a house. So you can develop, you can fully develop the oranges for $2,060, right? Which is only $500 more than what you started the game with. And if you've picked up some properties, you can mortgage them. If you've gone around the board at least three times, you've collected on average when you go around, you do collect $200, but on average, you're collecting about $170. So if you do the math, by the time you've captured that color group, you can fully develop them. And your return, your payoff return on them is about 23.5%, 24%. So every time somebody hits your property, you're getting back almost 24% of what you put in.
Yeah, yeah.
So once you understand that about the game, and here's the thing, like I know these numbers because I play for tournaments and I understand that. But what I find is funny is when people don't know these numbers and they just play the game a lot, they start to learn them instinctively.
They may not know the exact numbers, but they figure that they know that when they have the oranges, they do well.
Right. So that what they've figured out is that, hey, something's weird here. Something's crazy, right? My payback on the oranges is like 46% of what I put in when somebody hits it and it's fully developed. And my payoff and how many times I have to get hit is about 24%. They don't know those numbers, but they know when they play the game, the oranges are just demolishing and they don't know why, right? So then they start playing these numbers really, really heavily. Once you understand some of those intrinsic values, either by studying the numbers or by playing the game a lot, then you start having a different weight to what you trade. And then the game takes on this whole new life.
And then it becomes a negotiation game.
Yeah. So now the game turns into something like Settlers of Catan, right? Where people love that game because there's this trading element to it. Well, I need wool, but you have wood, and we're going to trade this because I need that. And then some other player at the table is like, don't trade him that. Don't you see? He's trying to build a fill in the blank. The exact same thing happens at Monopoly, except that players don't want to make each other mad, because when they're playing, you really, there's a certain level. You'll notice if you ever see a Monopoly tournament, people dress really well. They're very calm when they talk to each other. You know, they're not trying to swindle one another. Nobody's a used car salesman. They're comporting themselves very, very well. And when somebody's making a trade that isn't necessarily a beneficial trade, it's not uncommon, and in fact is encouraged, for a third and sometimes a fourth party to speak up and counter that trade. In fact, it's a strategy to enter trade negotiations with one player, knowing that another player is going to jump into the negotiation because it's a horrible trade that you're starting, right?
Do you know what that reminds me of? A totally different kind of game, but that reminds me of Cosmic Encounter.
That is an excellent point. Yes.
The whole reason why, because the rules of Cosmic Encounter are, you know, childishly simple, but the glory of that game is, yes, in the negotiations of, will you ally with me or will you ally with the person I'm attacking?
That's when you, again, if you look at the rules of Monopoly, there, it's not even a full page. They're very simple rules. And to some extent it is, roll your dice and move your mice, right? But then you get into the negotiation of it, much like Cosmic Encounters. You're in this place where, you know, stuff has to move around. And then if you take it to the next level and you start doing tournament play, which there are Cosmic Encounter tournaments, there are Monopoly tournaments, there are tournaments for just about every game you could imagine. There really truly are.
Oh yeah.
Now you've got a really, really cool experience that sadly, because of, in my opinion, both mishandling on the part of the game's owner and because of this perpetuated myth of like free parking or that, the, you know, don't bring things up for auction and that kind of stuff, the game has sadly fallen to the wayside. But I would encourage everyone to go out and play the game and follow the rules and just try it.
Read the rules, possibly for the first time in your life, and actually play the game properly.
And if you and some other house rules that change things. There are only 32 houses in the game. There are only 12 hotels. Don't add any houses. A housing shortage happens regularly in games. In fact, it's a tournament strategy to build up to 4 houses, but not go to hotels. Because once you go to hotels, the houses go back into the game.
Right. Yeah. So if you're holding on to them, other people can't build them.
Right. So really, if you have a couple of monopolies on the board, only 2 players are going to be able to get to where they need to be with houses.
This is reminding me more and more of Cosmic Encounter all the time.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, I'll bet you, and I would have to sit down and look at it, but I'll bet you there are many elements, mechanics of Cosmic Encounter borrowed from Monopoly.
I don't know about mechanics, but I think strategies, certainly.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah. Because of the player interaction.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think of other house rules. So there's only 32 houses in the hotel and 12 hotels in the game. Don't add any more. Let it play out, in which that if they're gone, they're gone. There's nothing you can do. There's only 28 deeds. If you don't buy it, it goes to auction, which is a strategy, by the way. For the most part, you're always going to want to buy a deed unless you can force 2 other players to get in a bidding war over it.
Right, and get them to overspend for it.
Exactly, yeah. Get them to overspend. Don't shuffle the chance or community chess cards when you go through them. Read the card on top and move it to the bottom. You don't shuffle in between. And the reason why is because the cards are very specific. So for instance, in chance, there's 10 cards that will move you. There's 2 cards that will reward you. They pay you from the bank. There's 2 cards that will penalize you. They'll take your money to the bank. There's 1 card that is a building cost. You have to pay for your houses. And there's 1 get out of jail, right? It's the same with community chest. That in that case, you have 9 cards that reward you, 3 that take money, 2 that move you, 1 that again pays for houses, and 1 that's get out of jail. But there's only 16 cards in each deck, and they should always move to the bottom. And the reason why is because the number of cards is very specific, and the number of rewards and penalties is very specific. And you should only see it once through, maybe twice when you play a game. And if you're playing in a tournament, it gives the players an opportunity to know what cards they've seen and what are coming up.
But here's the similarities to card counting again.
Again, yeah. If you know you've seen certain cards, but you haven't seen, for instance, the chance card that moves you to a certain property, you know that there's only 4 cards left in the chance deck, and one of those cards is going to move to a certain property. You can stack your housing on that property because you're going to be able to just crush one player when they take that card. I mean, that again, these are some of the simple strategies, but those are kind of the house rules that throw the game well out of whack. And that I would encourage people to just go and play. And if you're interested in tournaments, go online and, there aren't a lot of, sadly, again, I think this is mishandling on the company, but there aren't a lot of tournaments happening, you know, officially sanctioned tournaments, but that doesn't mean you can't do one yourself at your house. You can go get a tournament sheet offline and it takes four games. It's three rounds and then a final game. And there are point breakdowns that you'll be able to find for how many points you get if you're the only person left, or if there's two people left, three people left, four people left. How the points are divvied out. Play three rounds, and whoever the four people with the top points, they go on to the final table. Make sure to use aliases, otherwise you're going to have kingmakers who are trying to screw someone who has just enough points, that kind of thing. But play a few tournaments and end the game at 90 minutes. Really do. If the game's not done in 90 minutes, just call it. Count up your assets. Whoever has the most money wins, period.
All right. And on that note, I think we will draw this to a close. Thank you very much. This has been really educational.
Well, I hope people go out and play the game.
Yeah, I'm sure they will after this. I feel like playing again myself now.
I'd be happy to play with you anytime.
Next time I'm in Portland. So, Corey, where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
Well, if you're interested in kind of nerdy business stuff, you can find me at Corey Cassoni on Twitter, CoryCassoni. Please listen to the Surviving Creativity podcast. Just search Surviving Creativity, Google it. I'm sure you'll bring it up, or search it in iTunes. On the show, we talk about creative endeavors and new media technology. And outside of that, feel free to shoot me an email if you have any questions. I'm not hard to find. I do business stuff, and I'm nerdy as hell.
You've been listening to Unjustly Maligned with Anthony Johnston and Corey Cassoni. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. You can find more information, links and show notes at ump.fm. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Let's see. I believe it's Monopoly, the world's most famous game, and how it got that way.
Right.
And that goes into great detail. I mean, it's like a 200 page history of Monopoly, but it's a really fascinating read because it does go into depth about, who were these people at the turn of the century, just ordinary people, and what they gave to the game to make it what it is. It really was three decades of tweaking this game to become what it is, to become the game that it is.
Yeah.
And if you're interested in strategy, Phil has another book called The Monopoly Companion. It's the player's guide. And that goes into depth of and it's not a very long book. It's a really easy read, but it goes into depth about the percentages, payoff value, that kind of stuff. And I'm telling you, it teaches kids. And I play a lot of board games with my son, and I know a lot of people are like, now that D&D is big again, they're playing D&D with their kids, which I think is great. It socializes people in ways that you wouldn't imagine.
And teaches numeracy.
Yeah, absolutely. That's all stuff you can learn in Monopoly as well. The 70s through modern day, it was just utterly mishandled because it was a cash cow. They were making so much money on it.
Yeah, yeah. Success hides problems.
Well, they went the route of making versions, licensed versions of the game.
Yeah, well, and they still are, yeah.
Yeah, but for the first time in history, just a few years ago, Hasbro lost money on Monopoly because as we've entered the digital age, people have stopped collecting. Right?
Oh, wow.
So for the first time in forever, they lost a ton of money on Monopoly and they didn't know what was going on. They assumed it was because, and then they polled people and people said, oh, I don't play Monopoly, it takes too long. They assumed that was the problem. So the first thing they did is they tried to introduce digital money. So instead of handing each other cash, you had these little credit cards and these credit card machines, and you would swipe credit cards with each other.
But like, that's going to speed things up.
It actually took much longer because people would make a mistake. And then when they introduced it, it was very funny because they're in this huge press conference, all these people sitting here, and they're introducing this element. And one guy, one CEO hands the other CEO a credit card and he runs the wrong amount. He said, oh, you ran the wrong amount. Oh, how do I refund it? And they're standing up there for a very long time trying to... move this money back and forth. And everyone in the house who actually plays Monopoly is sort of snickering, like, you know, I could have handed you 120 paper Monopoly money dollars. Not complicated. Got notes.
So I hear.
Well, I have, you know, I have several books on the topic, so I wanted to make sure that I was prepared.
Wow. You have probably done more research for this show than any previous guest. I think that's probably fair to say.
Look, you have to, come on, you got to be prepped for this, right?
Well, sure. But I mean, you know, the prep for most of the guests consists of watching a movie and making some notes.
Stop it. That's unacceptable, sir. If you're going to defend an unjustly maligned love, then you have to be prepared when you come in.
Excellent. I'm sure everybody will appreciate it.
They better. Damn it. I spent a lot of time.
Hi, Erica.
Hi, Steven.
What are we doing here?
Well, we're talking about a Doctor Who podcast that we do together called Lazy Doctor Who.
Oh, really? What's that about?
It's where you and I watch Doctor Who from the very first episode, made in 1963, up to the present day, and then we talk about it on the podcast.
What, over 800 episodes of Doctor Who, from William Hartnell to Peter Capaldi, all in one sitting?
No, silly. We talk about each episode as we watch them. Or maybe we talk about a couple episodes per podcast, or however many we feel like watching in a particular night.
How on earth are we going to fit all of these podcasts in?
Well, that is the beauty of it. We record a podcast whenever we get around to it, and for however long we want to talk for. We're lazy like that.
So, it's a Doctor Who podcast where the hosts are kind of lazy, so...
Yep, Lazy Doctor Who. Find it on the Incomparable Network, on iTunes, or at lazydoctorwho.com.
Thanks for explaining that. I was feeling...
Lazy?
Yeah.